Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Robbins, the founder and managing director at the Anthony Michael Group, building companies and careers across the industry. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Jason Bilibram, who is the Vice President of Regulatory, Quality, and Compliance at Sekisui Diagnostics. Jason comes to us with over 30 years of experience working in regulated industries, especially in the functions of regulatory and quality. He holds his bachelor's degree in molecular biology and a master's of science in biomedical sciences. Prior to joining Sekisui, he's worked for household names in the industry like Smith & Nephew and AstraZeneca. For those unfamiliar with Sekisui Diagnostics, the company for over 40 years has been innovating and developing highly accurate diagnostics and biochemistry products to help improve patient outcomes across the world. The company's product portfolio includes a variety of reagents, enzymes, point-of-care testing, home tests, and more. So without further ado, Jason, thanks so much for being here. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to be here.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time to chat with us, and I'm excited to kind of dig into some of the insights that you have on what it's like being a quality and regulatory professional. We're going to talk about the industry. We're going to talk about a variety of things. But what I love to do on most of these shows is first and foremost, go back in time and talk about your formative years. So first and foremost, where'd you grow up and what was home life like?
Well, I grew up in Rhode Island. Spent a lot of time in Southern Rhode Island, of course, at the beaches, because, you know, who wouldn't? Played a lot of sports. Was fortunate to have, you know, a pretty good upbringing. Parents spent a lot of time, you know, at my games, and they've been very involved in my life. Have some very good friends that I'm still in contact with for 30, 40, 45 years. So very fortunate.
That's awesome. You mentioned sports. What were you into?
Baseball, football, wrestling. You know, them in middle school, high school, and a little bit in college. So it's, met a lot of people, did a lot of traveling. It was, you know, really, really a lot of fun.
Good for you. And do you have siblings?
No, it's just me. I have some very close friends that I consider, you know, almost like family, but no brothers or sisters.
What were you into outside of sports as a kid? You're in a very science-driven industry, and you have been, like I said, for over 30 years. What else held your interest outside of school other than sports?
Sports was a big part of my upbringing. Did some traveling, you know, my family traveled a bit. Got a chance to see, you know, a lot of the United States mostly. Doing things with my friends, just normal, you know, 70s, 80s upbringing, you know. Yeah. And spent a lot of time outside and not many video games. So things were very, very different.
Sounds great to me. I've got kids that we're bringing up now, and the amount of stuff that is based on technology, I think, is just such a different world.
It's just different. You know, I don't know if it's better or worse. And, you know, there are times when, I have those discussions. I have a daughter and a son, daughter in college and son in high school. And, I have those discussions with them. And, you know, I learn from them. They learn from me. And a lot of, like, what was it like then? And, you know, I see how they do things now. So I don't know if it's better or worse. It's just different.
Different is probably the best term for the sake of this show. Otherwise, you and I could go on forever on it. But
right.
What I was getting at is I'm curious where you started to take an interest in the life sciences and in what you're doing now, because, we mentioned that you went to school. You had, I think, we said at the beginning, molecular biology, correct? As an undergrad, did you have an interest in science and stuff as you were growing up, or how'd you end up in this space?
Yeah, I've always had a soft spot for animals. You know, pets, even like farm animals, goats. Like, always wanted to have a small farm. Hopefully someday I will. But I really, you know, connect with animals, and my original intention was to be a vet. You know, I really wanted to grow up to be a veterinarian. So, you know, I think that's what got me started in science. And, you know, in high school, it was kind of like, well, if I want to do this, like, I probably need to take, you know, talk to a few people, and they're like, you should take biology, you should do this, you should do that. I think that's probably what started me down that path.
Nice. And then the running joke on this show is that most of us didn't, you know, have a clear line of sight as to what we were going to do when we came out of school, especially in regulatory and quality. How did this all come about? Because I know back in the day, you were working for AstraZeneca. I think you did some manufacturing engineering, perhaps. But tell us more, if you would, how you became the RAQA guy.
Yeah. So I my intention was a veterinary at one point. Then it was like, I think I want to do research, right? And I did that at local hospital, affiliate with Brown, Roger Williams. And I learned a lot. I think the main thing I learned is that was not what I wanted to do. You know, it's not what I had pictured it. So it kind of left me like just before school, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? You know, if I'm not going to go into research. And meanwhile, you know, I was kind of finishing up my undergrad and you know, thinking, well, what am I going to do? I had applied to some graduate schools. And originally I was planning to do a PharmD. You know, I had been in the process of getting accepted. And meanwhile, I was doing this internship with Astra, and then became AstraZeneca. And, you know, I did that through the summer and learned a ton and had some very, very good mentors. People, you know, recognized globally for quality regulatory. So I did that over the summer, and then I was getting ready to leave to do my PharmD and on with the next part of my life. And they came to me and said, hey, we'd like you to stay. We'd like you to work here. And I was like, all right, whatever. And they gave me an offer and went home, talked to my parents. And they said, well, ask for this, this, and this. And, you know, they won't give you that. And you can go your own way in a good way. Don't burn any bridges. So I did that. I went back and they said, okay, we'll do that. So I said, okay. Thought about it and just deferred my PharmD and took the job at Astra. And then that was really the beginning of my quality and regulatory career.
What do you think? What's very rare that I see is people who are, you know, perhaps on the commercial side of the business, and they end up making a transition and come to quality and regulatory. And for the most part, it's the same vice versa. What do you think some of the misconceptions are about quality and regulatory?
I mean, I've heard a lot of things, but, you know, and I'll say this. I think, I think general people, quality regulatory people are considered, you know, introverts, you know, people that, you know, kind of want to just like do their own thing and kind of like sit back and behind the scenes and, you know, maybe, you know, I've heard the word controlling at times, maybe not me, but just in general, you know, so I think, you know, yeah, sometimes quality and regulatory people get a bad rap. They're not, you know, they don't want to be part of the team. They want to kind of just do their own thing and, you know, that's it. But, you know, I don't think that's true across the board. And I feel like, you know, I've been someone that in prior lives that they've come to me and they've actually wanted me to do marketing and be involved in transition teams and in M&A because, you know, I was more dynamic and I could work with a team to kind of create connections. And I think, you know, the best regulatory and quality people can work in what's called the gray area, right? They work in this area that's like right near the line of compliance and not compliance, and can also, like, you know, work and understand and appreciate some of the commercial challenges. So, QARA people get a bad rap sometimes, but I think the good people can work in and, you know, across all the different functions and be dynamic and, you know, bring some personality and fun to the table.
I'm glad you did say that. And I was almost hoping that that's what you were going to say, because I too think these functional areas get a bad rap. And I think that they get labeled when there's so many dynamic people. And I would argue that you can be introverted, but first and foremost, like, you are the crux of bringing products to market and keeping them safe. And products don't come to market without working with your cross-functional partners and actually having conversations and setting a strategy that makes sense and gets the business objectives accomplished but still, like you said, operate in the gray and stay compliant. And I just feel like the term I've used in the past is almost redheaded stepchild, especially in the actual company, where historically it's like these functions didn't necessarily have the voice that they deserve. And I think it's starting to change more and more over the years. And people are starting to realize the importance of a regulatory strategy, especially very early on, and kind of the criticality of having the right person, you know, at the helm of that space.
You know, I would say, I think if you talk to my current teams, they would say, you know, there's a few things they hear from me is one, you know, be patient, right? The other one is, you know, how are we going to bring value, right? How do we stay relevant? It's a question for everyone, every function, every person, right? So, but as an organization, you know, how do we help, you know, commercial? How do we help, you know, enable, like you talked about regulatory strategy. That's a great example. How do we enable, you know, growth and progress? And that helps everyone, right? So I certainly support that. I think it's a really important concept. And I think, you know, the successful companies embrace regulatory and quality more for, you know, being a partner and being someone who can enable opportunities, especially outside the U.S., you know, with IBDR and just the growth of, you know, Middle East, Lower Asia, India, for example.
Mm-hmm. 100%. You know, one of the other things I like to bring up on the show is that there's many, many people out there who are listening, and they're probably thinking to themselves, hey, I'm a director now, I'm a manager now, I want to be a first-time manager, but ultimately, I want to lead the department, and I want to be the top dog, so to speak. And it's great to have aspirations, but it's interesting to me how two people with fairly similar backgrounds, similar motivations, similar aspirations, one will make it and the other one won't. What do you think? I guess my question is loaded in a couple of different directions, so I'll break it down. The first piece is, looking back on your own career, what are perhaps some of the pivotal moments that you think really helped catalyze your ability to get to where you're at today?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, so I mean, I'll say this, you know, I think at some point in your career, you stop making decisions for yourself and you stop making decisions that for other people, right? And you know, what I mean there is that, you know, at some point I have to manage my career, but then at, you know, some point you start looking around going, well, my decision affects thousands of people, right? So I think, you know, it's really important that, you know, as you kind of move through your career and, you know, some of the pivotal things for me has always been, you know, I think honesty. I've been very honest with people. And, you know, I don't think people were ready for my honesty. You know, I think I've always tried to do the right thing. You know, and I've stayed open-minded. You know, I would recommend to people, and I recommend to my teams, like, things aren't always going to turn out how you expect, right? And it's not, you know, a lot of times people will call me with bad news, right? Things are not going well. And really the first thing I say is, you know, is everyone okay? Is the patient okay? Is everything good? Well, yeah. It's like, okay, so now what are we going to do? How are we going to fix it, right? And pivot almost immediately to, you know, problem solving and working with the team and you know, and encouraging, you know, people and, you know, giving people the support that they need. And I think at every level, you know, VP to director, director to manager, you know, manager to individual contributor. You know, I think those are the kinds of things that I think make people, it's the difference between people being successful. The people that honestly paying attention and listening and really understanding how their role affects everyone.
I'm going to push you a little bit more. I'm going to sum up what I heard you say. One, you've been honest, and sometimes in a manner of, hey, it might be brutally honest feedback, but it's necessary and in the best interest of who I'm around. Two, you know, keeping your eyes and ears open and paying attention to what's going on and understanding kind of how you fit into the bigger picture.
Yep.
Three, obviously patient first, and then kind of work backwards and, you know, from the criticality of what's going on and then put solutions to it. But you can get to most people can get to a director spot. They do a good job. You know, they cut their teeth as a manager. They realize that, hey, being a good technician, so to speak, doesn't make you a good manager. So they figure it out and somehow they get known to be a decent leader and they find themselves in a director spot. Most people cap out there, though. There's only so many vice president positions in the industry. Yeah. There's got to have been more to this as to why, what happened as to why you were able to continue to rise up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. You know, I can say for me, you know, I think, you know, everybody has to be opportunistic, right? You know, at one point in my career, I said to myself, you know, I stayed in a place too long. Right. And I learned, you know, I'll never do that again. Right. And, you know, I've made mistakes and, you know, I think, you know, I've owned those mistakes and I've learned from them, you know, and I think, you know, if I look around at, like, you know, I have some very close friends that are directors and a couple of them are out of work right now and they really can't get work. And I look at these people and go, they're really good people. They're good people. And they're really capable leaders. So, I mean, sometimes it's just timing and luck. I also think, you know, for myself, I sit down every once in a while and you know, say to myself, like, how do I keep myself relevant? And you know, this is an example, right, where I'm not super comfortable sitting in front of a camera and you know, doing this. And I'm not uncomfortable, but I'm not super comfortable. And you know, I've thought about, do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? And I've said, I'm trying to stretch outside my zone because this type of stuff is relevant and it challenges me and you can learn stuff, right? So I think a big part of it is between director and VP is people willing to, like, put themselves out there and try things and say, hey, I'm going to do this or I'm going to take more responsibility. And sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. But the people that aren't willing to try and, you know, kind of just, you know, see what happens, I think sometimes it becomes a self-limiting activity. I think that's a big part of it.
So we have a fairly good listener base, but I am also understanding of the fact that not everybody listens to every single episode. So what may seem on repeat to some is brand new to others. I'm going to say that I got chills when you just said that, and I'll tell you why. Between two different shows over the years, I've interviewed probably well over 200 people. Every single VP at 100% rate, every single executive who's a VP or in the C-suite has said the exact same thing that you just came to, which was, you got to put yourself out there. You got to take risks. You got to find ways to be okay with being uncomfortable. And it's a fact. And I think that you're an inspiration to be here today, recognizing that, hey, this might not necessarily be, you know, your total comfort zone to sit here with me, but you're doing it. And it's just a testament to what you just said and demonstrates that you're doing it, literally doing it yourself. So I think for those that are listening, like, I can't stress enough how many times I've heard from people at Jason's level and folks running companies at the top, like, you have to find ways to take risk, calculated risk. If there's a project that you can volunteer for that maybe it's not necessarily your complete expertise, but you can quickly adapt and learn, guess how much visibility that's going to create, right? And if you fail, hey, I think people would still respect you as you should respect yourself for taking a chance and trying. And I'm sure you probably, with your own failures, Jason, have realized that they're not necessarily failures if you learned and changed things moving forward. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes you make a mistake and you don't realize the benefit of it for years. And some you'll look back and be like, huh. Right. But, you know, in the moment or even like in the next year or so, you don't realize. But yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot by taking opportunities and making mistakes. And like you said, calculated mistakes, you you make a lot of big mistakes, you won't be in this industry very long.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But, you know, and the other thing I'll say too that, you know, makes like the VP level as well is, you know, make your boss's job easier, right? If you can make your boss's job easier, it'll provide you opportunity to grow because they'll give you more chances and they'll want you, you know, with them, you know, helping and contributing to the organization, and, you know, bigger opportunities will come. I also, you know, I really think that's an important concept for people coming up.
That's a great piece of advice. The other thing I would add on is that I've encouraged people over time who are, you know, feel like they're competent and ready for the next step. What I encourage them to do is find out what is your boss doing that you're not doing? And mm-hmm. how can you work with your boss to maybe take some of that responsibility and get a taste of it so that you can start to identify where the gaps are? And if you don't know, ask, hey, I want to be you someday. Where do you see the gaps? What do you think I need to develop to do this? And I think the sign of a great leader is somebody who is willing and ready to mentor that person, because the sign of a great leader is basically the people that go on to be promoted, right? There's a reason that that happens. So, and I think that sometimes ego gets in the way for a lot of people where they want to keep people down because if they rise up, what does that mean for me? And I don't think that's the right way to look at it personally.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I've probably done that myself in the past. Like, you learn, right? As you go through life, your perspective changes. And, you know, I have people in my organization now that are very good. And, you know, I you know, one person in particular that, you know, I would view as, you know, when I go on to do the next thing, you know, they would potentially be a replacement for me. And, you know, they have gaps, you know, and we talk about them. And, you know, like I asked, you know, this person, you know, are you interested, you know, to your point? And these are the types of things you have to be willing to do. And, you know, you have to kind of be okay with that. So, you know, there's a process there. If you're fortunate enough to have someone above you that cares about you and your career, that's a big advantage, because, you know, I've been in situations where the person above me, from my view, didn't, right? Yep. And it makes it not impossible, but it makes it difficult. And sometimes you have to make decisions that are in the best interest of you.
And that's in part why I have a job, Jason.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
You don't necessarily have to come up with the absolute best piece of advice, but is there a piece of advice that you've gotten from mentors along the way that has stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a regulatory boss at Smith & Nephew who I think really kind of helped me shape like my philosophy, my professional view on stuff. And, you know, she said things like, you know, integrity is really important. You know, there's a line and you can't cross that as a regulatory person, because bad things will happen. Right. And you have to be good enough that you can, you know, enable the business to move forward and keep them in compliance. Like, that's the challenge. But, you know, and she told me a long time ago, and I was thinking a manager, there'll be times in your life then you may have to choose whether you're going to do what people want you to do, or you're going to, you know, maybe not do it and exit the company. She's like, there will be very difficult decisions. I think she really helped me, and I've talked to her over the years about things, and she's helped me, you know, carve out, if you will, my, you know, next opportunity. So, you know, I think integrity is really an important part. I think, you know, being consistent and being fair. Like, I think if you talk to a lot of the people I've worked with over the years, especially people reporting to me, they would say I'm pretty fair. Like, am I tough? Yeah. Do I hold people to the same standard that I hold myself to? I do. But I feel like I've always been very consistent. And even when I've had to give people difficult information, like, for example, hey, like, I know you want to be a director, right? But you're not ready. But I usually follow it up with, but I'm willing to work with you. And if you do these three or four things, we'll give you the directorship. And every single time I've said that, I think every time it's happened, like we've gotten people there when I've made that commitment. So, you know, I think integrity, you know, your word and your commitment to your people is, you know, keep those things right. And I think, you know, you'll have a good core of, you know, things that you do and, you know, people will respect you for that. And, you know, you'll be able to be successful.
I think the best piece I took from that just now was the direct feedback that you've given and is actually in the best interest of the person in front of you. But then you put the accountability on them. You're like, I'm showing you the path. This is where the gap is. This is what needs to happen. It's up to you if you want to get this done, and I'll support you. Versus people say, yeah, you're not ready, and they don't really say why, or they don't even say you're not ready. They just pass you over for somebody outside the organization. And then what do you know? Resentment sets in, and the person exits the company anyways. So yeah. I love that.
Yep. It's hard when you're really busy, right? And you got $1 million products that aren't moving out the door, you know, $20 million products, and you're trying, you know, you have a manager who's trying to figure out their career, and you have a CEO calling you going, you know, why isn't my $20 million product shipped?
Yeah.
And you're trying to worry about these two things. But, you know, I still think to this day, like people, it's not all people. I mean, systems are important, but people are a very important part of the process. And we need, you know, good leaders, I believe, understand that and operate in a way to enable people as best they can.
What's your favorite leadership book or business book for that matter?
I mean, I've read a fair amount. I mean, we've been encouraged to read them. I mean, you know, the Five Habits of a Successful, you know, person. Probably, you know, I'm a very like checklist, KPI, like goal oriented person. So, you know, I like, you know, habits and structures and, you know, frameworks of like, you know, hey, how can you get from A to B? And I think it's really interesting when you read a book, any one of these, you know, people will maybe call them self-help or advice book, you know, it, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, you can take these concepts and actually like put them in play and actually watch them happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's really interesting. And then I've also taken the book and read stuff back to people. And I think it's a really interesting part of the process. I'm glad you asked that. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge reader, but I like to take bits and pieces of different books and advice or things that I see and put them into play. And some work well and some don't. But I think it's really interesting. I do.
I think it's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, the Stephen Covey book. Is that the one you're referring to?
Okay.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the biggest piece about reading that I've gotten caught up with myself is sometimes I was reading, thinking that I was doing a good thing for myself by reading, and realizing, wait, you could read 5 books and put them down and do nothing, or you could read 1 book and implement something and actually see results. So I think there's a balance there, right? Of how much you read versus how much you implement, which is the whole purpose of reading in the first place.
Yeah, I will say it's like assuming like leadership is very, very at the front, right? Like we had a HR person, and we've had some good HR people, but we had someone who was come and gone, and she was really encouraging us at one time to read different books or would take snippets at like, you know, executive meetings and talk about different concepts. And, you know, it was very valuable, but I agree. I mean, you can read, you know, forever, but, you know, you gotta be able to take, you know, these things and put them into practice. So, you know, I try to pick and choose, you know, when a new book comes out or you hear someone talking about, you know, a new concept, I listen. You know, some are good, some aren't for me, but yeah, I've been able to put a lot of things in play. And, you know, I like to, you know, the social psychology of it. Like, I think it's interesting, you know, what motivates people, you know, as a leader, you know, there's a lot of different styles. Some people you have to get fired up. Some people you have to really handhold, right? You got to really figure out, you know, what motivates your next line of, you know, leaders and what works, you know. And I'm not one that believes one size fits all. And, you know, I think in even different cultures, I've been in very, very different cultures in the companies I've worked for, and I've had to change styles. So it's, you know, it can be a lot, but it's rewarding when people are successful.
I'm going to ask you a super loaded question, super loaded. And that is what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges regulatory and quality leaders are going to be facing in 2025?
You know, I could say, you know, without letting maybe too much intel out. You know, I mean, there's concerns with, you know, change. You know, I don't want to get into politics, but tariffs, right? I mean, we're a global company. We import stuff. You know, we sell stuff globally. And, you know, some of the questions have been, you know, will we be able to move stuff around as effectively, raw materials in, finished products, especially into, you know, like, of course, China and even, you know, North America have you know, been mentioned recently. You know, I think those are challenges. And, you know, I think one of the other big things is, you know, the world's becoming more and more electronic and software based. I mean, you know, if you ask, I think, FDA or a lot of the regulatory agencies, you know, cybersecurity is a big area, you know, relates to AI. And, you know, I think we're, as well as other companies, trying to figure that out. There's a big regulatory component to that. I think those are the big issues, you know, just like, how do we go faster and, you know, how do we, you know, make more complex products with software safer, you know, it's some of the same, you know, but, yeah, I mean, keeping up with technology, I think in general is probably the biggest thing for on the regulatory side. And on quality, you know, I think honestly, quality, one of the biggest challenges for a lot of companies is, and I think we learned this from the pandemic, is, you know, reliable raw material sources, you know, being able to get products that are reliable and be able to get enough. You know, I think people are still struggling with that. A lot of companies went out of business. So I think that'll continue to be a big challenge as well.
What's your thought on AI right now as it relates to regulatory? Because I see stuff posted on a daily basis, and I see the rate of how fast AI is evolving, that you can't help but wonder how much of regulatory is going to be initially done with AI, with somebody perhaps overseeing it. But I'd love your perspective on that.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this the regulatory bodies, you know, U.S., OUS, still wrapping their arms around cybersecurity. So I think they're tackling that one first, and then beyond that, yeah, AI is interesting. I mean, they're using it for, you know, right now for, you know, looking at, you know, comparison of a radiologist in a critical imaging reading for, you know, potentially, you know, different types of cancers, you know, and it's being shown that it's much better in some cases, right? But I think that has to be really understood. And I think there is tremendous potential for it. But, you know, I'm not sure it's like everything else. It's good across the board, right? And then it's also like everything else, how do we regulate it? How do we make sure it's working the way it's supposed to? And both the industry and, of course, the regulatory bodies want to monitor it in the field. So, you know, I think it's amazing. Like, even using it for meetings, right? Like, it takes all the notes now and identifies the person that speaks. And, you know, you get this right when the meeting's over, you get this whole printout of everything. I was like, this is fantastic, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I absolutely support it. But, you know, from a quality regulatory standpoint, yeah, it makes me wonder, like, you know, are we doing the right thing? You know, what are the things that other people are running into? And, you know, critical operations, life sustaining, you know, types of products, you know, how do we make sure it's reliable? you know, it works and it helps, but like, you know, what's the downside? Because unfortunately, there's always a downside. So I think those are the questions, you know, and I, you know, we have good people in industry and in, you know, US, you know, FDA, et cetera. And, you know, I think it'll get figured out, but it's going to take a few years for sure.
When it comes to document control and, you know, perhaps work that regulatory specialists and things do, you think it's going to replace people?
I think it has the potential. Yeah. I think it can do, you know, I think it can, but I mean, I think in some ways, like we've already, I can speak for, you know, some of my direct experience, you know, we've automated a lot of our operations already, you know, and I think there's a, maybe a, still a gap that AI could apply to. Like, I don't think it's going to like reduce the size of teams by 50%, but yeah, I think there's certain areas that you can automate and make, you know, kind of smart where it can, you know, make basic decisions. Yeah, I do think there's an opportunity.
It's unbelievable what's going on with it. I think it's, say it on a lot of the shows recently, I think it's coming for all of us. It's just a matter of who is willing and ready to harness, do their best to harness the power of what it can do and be in charge of the AI versus letting the AI take over what you're doing.
I mean, that's the question. It's like everything else. Like, you know, it's like it potentially is like unlimited, right? But, you know, do we want it to be unlimited?
Right.
You know, I think there's a middle ground, like I said, everything else, right? So, I mean, I'm excited. You know, I use automation in the house, you know, in some degree, some AI where things come on and off and do all that. And I think that's pretty cool, but that's pretty simple, right? When you start doing much bigger things, even running, like, you know, like we have an EQMS, we had AI, you know, logging things and doing stuff. I think there's, in the long run, a lot of benefit, but I think upfront, right? Validation, verification, making sure this stuff is actually doing, we're going to cut it loose and let it make its own decisions. You know, you got to be, you know, very, very confident that it's making the right decisions, you know? So, you know, I think that maybe it'd be more work up front and then in the long run, it'll pay it back. So, you know, I support it, but I don't know what it'll look like in 3 or 4 years. I'm curious to see.
And I think that's where I see it evolving, is that it's going to do a lot of the heavy lifting up front, but somebody's going to still have to manage it and oversee it, because it makes mistakes all the time. And sure, it gets better with iterations, but I think it's going to be the person, the human, who has the knowledge base to review and say, yeah, this looks pretty darn good. What would have taken me, you know, 35 hours took me 5 hours.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, you know, and the best AI now learns from a collection of available information, right? Like scanning is a big area, ultrasounds, MRI, CAT scan. Right. Like every result you generate that you put in this database, the AI gets, in theory, better. Right. Yeah. So it's like this relationship of like humans, educating, if you will, right, populating this database, and the AI, I don't think the term learning is right, but like gaining more information to help make decisions is, yeah. I mean, I don't see it. I think it'll be a long time before AI could operate almost autonomously, right? It's almost scary to say, but like,
yeah, no,
I think there's always going to be an input aspect to it, because I don't think, at least in our lifetimes, that it's going to think for itself. But who knows? I could be completely wrong.
You and I will be talking in 3-4 years and see where we're at, I guess, right?
Yeah. Who knew, right? It's like,
yeah,
wow,
no,
you know, I don't even know if I want that, right? Do I want AI that can think for itself?
I don't think any of us do. It turns into that, make a reality what used to be a movie. What is that Will Smith movie, iRobot or whatever, where they basically take over?
I mean, there's been a lot of movies that have not gone so well with AI,
yeah,
robots, right, and all that. So, I mean, you know, I think, you know, hopefully, I'm sure people are aware of that. And, you know, of course, that can't possibly happen.
Listen, man, you've shared so many great pieces of insight and value today. I really appreciate you being here. If it's okay, what we'll do on the show notes is put a link to your LinkedIn profile. We'll put a link to Sekisui, and we'll encourage anybody who's interested to be able to reach out.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was good. I mean, hopefully I gave you some bits and pieces of good stuff and good questions, by the way. I mean, I enjoyed it, you know, and if there's anything else I can do to help or contribute to any other ideas you have, I'd be more than happy to do it.
That's awesome, man. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Jason Bilibrand. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.